for a study of the book of Genesis. I'm on page 200. Genesis 47:27. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, and they acquired property in it, and were fruitful and became very numerous. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Please, if I've found favor in your sight, please now, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place, in the place where his fathers are buried." That's the cave of Machpelah Abraham bought for that purpose. And he, that's Joseph, said, "I will do as you said." And he, that's Jacob, said, "Swear to me." So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. Jacob has 17 more years of life once he is reconnected with Joseph in Egypt. Gives him a chance to spend good time together. But he makes Joseph swear that he will not bury him in Egypt, but he will take him to Canaan, to Machpelah, to bury him there with his fathers. Abraham and Sarah are buried there. Eventually, Jacob and Leah are buried there. There was no oath more sacred than swearing upon a man's thigh. Now, that's a euphemism. We'll get to this in a minute. If you swore on a man's thigh, that was the biggest oath you could take. Abraham made Eleazar swear on his thigh that he would find a bride for Isaac, his son, among his people, and not take somebody from the other world. And he did. He did not want Isaac to be taken back to Ur of the Chaldees in the event of Abraham's death. Swearing on a man's thigh is a euphemism for swearing on his genitals. The implication is that if you break your oath to me, the descendants in my genitals will hunt you down and kill you. Now, it's a different world. It's a different culture. And one of the most important things people can do is bear children to continue their line. And these are shepherding people. These are people who are used to living with all that day in and day out. They're not squeamish about things we're squeamish about. And so when you ask somebody to swear on your thigh, that's what that meant. I think the modern translators had a hard time writing exactly what it meant. It came about after these things that Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is sick." So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. And when it was told to Jacob, "Behold, your son has come to you," Israel collected his strength and sat up in the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me." That they became known as Bethel. And he said to me, "Behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous. I will make you a company of peoples, and I will give you this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. Now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. I'm going to adopt your two sons as my sons, and they will each have an inheritance in Israel equal with all my other sons." So instead of 12 portions being given out, there'll be 14 portions given out. So he's adopting him, making them his sons. That, in other words, he's basically, be 13 boys, he's basically giving Joseph two portions, because he would have gotten one from one son, but now he's getting two portions.
Wouldn't that make it 13?
Right, it's 13. You're correct.
Oh.
You're correct. So they are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. But your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. As for me, when I come from Padan, Rachel died. And to my sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem, and I buried her on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. So he's moaning about losing the burial site for Rachel. Now, when you look at the tribes of Israel, two of the tribes are Manasseh and Ephraim, and there is no tribe of Joseph. And that's because Manasseh and Ephraim are both tribes of Joseph. So that's when you sit down and count out the tribes. There's 13 of them, but only 12 of them get land. And that's because the Levites didn't get land. We'll get to that in a minute. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" And Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons whom God has given me. Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." So when he first got there, his father told him he was going to adopt these two boys, and Joseph brings them forward. Who is this? "These are my sons. I will bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were so dim from age that he could not see. Remember, Isaac went through this earlier on. Then Joseph brought them close, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face, and now God has let me see your children as well." Then Joseph took them from Ephraim and from his knees, and he bowed his face to the ground. And Joseph took both Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right, and he brought them close in. He was trying to get them where the firstborn would be blessed by the right hand and the secondborn would be blessed by the left hand, in keeping with the tradition. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was younger, and the left hand he placed on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. So he crossed over. And he blessed Joseph, and he said, "God, the God before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. And may my name live on in them, and may the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." When Joseph saw that his father had laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him. And he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand upon his head." So Joseph's already thinking of Manasseh as his firstborn and his heir. And yet Jacob has flopped the blessing. And Jacob, but his father refused. He said, "I know, my son, I know. He shall become a people, and he shall also be great. However, his younger brothers shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." And he blessed them that day. "By you, Israel, shall pronounce blessing, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. And I give you one more portion than your brothers, which I took from the land of the Amorite with my sword and my bow." So he's trying to make up for all the loss, and he's of his love for Joseph, and he's blessed him two portions and changed the order of authority to give Ephraim the authority over his brother. Now remember, Isaac had the same situation where the second-born son, Jacob, wound up getting his first blessing. There's a whole history of that.
Wayne?
Yeah?
What does that last part mean, "which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and bow"?
The land of Canaan is the land of Amor. In the whole process of doing all of this, there were warfares and battles and stuff like that. So it's don't think of it as like all-inclusive. But the Amorites and the Canaanites. The Amorites are a bigger group than the Canaanites. The Canaanites are Amorites who live in Canaan.
And they were enemies.
Who?
The Amorites and the Canaanites.
They're the same people. Okay, and they were sometimes enemies with Israel.
I have a question. In the Exodus, that Joshua was of the Ephraim tribe.
Yes.
Do we know what tribe Moses would have been of?
Levi.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right, because of Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, when we talk about that, I'm going to talk about this right now. Jacob installs Ephraim, the second-born son, over Manasseh, the first-born son. This does not please Joseph, but he cannot control Jacob's blessing. Ephraim becomes the leader of the 10 northern tribes down through time. So when the tribes split between the two southern tribes and the 10 northern tribes, Ephraim is the leader of the 10 northern tribes, so he becomes king over that group of people. Joshua, the son of Nun, was from the tribe of Ephraim, so leadership flows out of Ephraim rather than out of Manasseh. Jacob's lifelong interaction with God, some of which were admittedly not positive, had given him a great deal of spiritual discernment. Isaac had not wrestled with God so much so he lacked the discernment to distinguish between two sons he'd known for 20 years. So Isaac, when he thought he was dying prematurely, some 30 years before he actually did, his eyesight was failing, and he called for his son Esau to come that he might be blessed. And Jacob's mother slipped Jacob in ahead of him and whatever. Isaac could not discern between two sons that he'd known for 20 years. Jacob is able to discern between two grandsons he's just met, which one God will have as the leader and which one he won't. Jacob had discernment to distinguish between grandsons he never met. God does not love our bad behaviors, but he can redeem them if we let him. The sheer process of interacting with God, sometimes punitively, sometimes God's punishing him, sometimes God's dealing with him, and sometimes God's blessing him. But the interaction with God is relationship, and that causes him to rub off on you, as it were. Genesis 49. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, "Assemble yourselves, that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father." This is his last will and testament. And basically, he's going to assign some things and prophesy some things over his sons on his deathbed. So this is an official event. "Reuben," he says, "you are my firstborn, my might and beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. You are my first boy, and all should have gone to you. You had preeminence over all of your brothers. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, and you defiled it. He went up to my couch." So, how would you like that to be your inheritance? Jacob gives his final blessings, some of which are actually curses, and he prophesies over his sons. It is his final will and testament to his sons. Reuben loses his inheritance as firstborn because of his indiscretion with Bilhah in Genesis 35. Bilhah was Rachel's maid and Joseph's nurse. And so she did all the hands-on raising of Joseph, teaching and all this kind of stuff when Rachel was busy taking care of Jacob, which is a lot. And so she's very influential with Joseph. Reuben is seeing that he's losing his position as the first of the family and that it's going to Joseph. And in an attempt to regain some control, he approaches Bilhah and has an affair with her. Now, she's older than him by a good bit, but he has an affair with Bilhah so that he can use her to control Joseph and have Joseph sort of lean his way and that sort of thing. Jacob finds out about it, and there's a big stink, as you can imagine. And here on the deathbed, Jacob says, "Because of that, you will not be first, because you violated my bed. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." So number two, Simeon, number three, Levi, would have been next in line to inherit the leadership position, the kinsman redeemer role, the head of the tribe. And they disqualified themselves in Shechem when they entered into a covenant with the people of Shechem to be circumcised. And then while they were in the fever of their circumcision, took a bunch of men, went in and slaughtered all the men and killed a bunch of animals and took up all the women and put Jacob's tribe in a position of having to flee from all the neighbors around there who were related to him. In the process of that flight away from Shechem, Jacob had actually stopped in Shechem and bought property there to settle down because Rachel was close to delivering her second child and he wanted her not to have to travel. Well, because of this stunt, they had to flee and Rachel died in childbirth on the road. And they basically had to dig a hole in the ground and throw her in it. They couldn't put her in Machpelah or a nice place like that. And Jacob never forgave them for it, that they cost him Rachel's life in that process. Simeon and Levi share a common fate because of the massacre that they led at Shechem. They were passed over in leadership because they put the tribe in jeopardy at Shechem because of the seduction of Dinah, their sister. So anybody who's this hot-headed and vituperative and likely to go to guns and whatever, has no business being president, has no business being the head of the tribe, because they will only get you in trouble. You don't want to leave your tribe in the hands of these guys, because they'll go nuclear first opportunity. That's who they are. So they're disqualified. Because of their deception and treachery, Rachel died in premature childbirth with Benjamin. Rachel was Jacob's beloved wife. Levi's people became Israel's landless butchers down through the ages. The tribe of Levi largely redeems himself at Sinai when they came in defense of Moses against the people while Moses up on the mountain, they had gone into idolatry. And Moses called out for support for God, and the tribe of Levi came. So that redeemed them in the hand of God, but they got no land. They became the priests of all of Israel. Remember when they got to Sinai, God said, your firstborn belong to me. First of all, they're the tithe of your fruit, of your loins. And the second is I saved them from death in Egypt when the death angel passed over. Your firstborn belong to me. But you need your firstborn to run your families. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the tribe of Levi, and man for man, I'm going to exchange them for your firstborn. In fact, when we read Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, which people don't read, you see that there was about 240 more firstborn than there were Levites. And so they had to go out and find 240 non-Levites to fill in here. So because it was man for man. So the Levites then became the priests rather than the firstborn of Israel. And as the priest, their main job was to offer the sacrifice. Hence they got good with a knife, and they became Israel's butchers down through history. In fact, if you remember Fiddler on the Roof, without which no man can see God, you remember that Laser Wolf was a butcher. He was the Levite. He was the family butcher. So if you wanted to make a sacrifice, you'd go to the Levite, and he would kill it for you in a sacrificial manner. If you wanted to kill a bull or a lamb or whatever for food purposes, you go to the Levite, and he would kill it. And if you wanted to have a meal or something, that you didn't have a bunch of sheep, you couldn't kill one every Friday. You just needed a little bit of meat, not whatever. You would go to the Levite, and he would kill some sheep or cattle or whatever. And then he would package it and sell it out of his house there. So you get in the book, in the story about Fiddler on the Roof, you get Zidel, the firstborn, coming to Laser Wolf's butcher shop, and she's watching him make sure she gets a fair measure of the meat, and he's looking at her because he thinks she's pretty hot. So at any rate, the Levites became the butchers, the priests and butchers of all of Israel in place of the firstborn. Simeon had no such luck. They just disappeared in Judah. Over time, they just got absorbed in Judah. They were incapable of basically managing themselves over time. Genesis 49:8, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Judah's name means praise, if you remember. Your brothers shall indeed praise you, he means. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. I'm making you the firstborn. I'm making you the head of the tribe. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son has gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. Shiloh is an Old Testament name for the Messiah. So until Shiloh comes, Judah will rule. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, his teeth white from milk. He's going to be royal. He's going to be royal, Judah. So Judah will become Israel's shining star, a ruler among his brothers. He is seen as noble and powerful over time. Judah will, Jacob prophesies as he dies, progenerate a specific ruler of enormous significance, the Messiah. While Judah was no less sinful than his brothers, and was, in fact, the instigator of Joseph being sold in Egypt as a slave, Judah learned how to repent, a trait he passed down to King David and others of his descendants, and this restored him to both Jacob and to God. Remember, in 38th chapter of Genesis, we read about where Judah had left the family and had gone away to live by himself among the Canaanites. That's unheard of, to leave your tribe and the protection of your tribe. You have to have a serious reason for doing that. The rabbis say that his guilt was too heavy. His father was in grief constantly, and his guilt was too heavy on him, so he left. And while he was gone, he had a Canaanite wife, three sons who were raised up, and they first one married a gal named Tamar. God struck him dead, then he struck the second one dead. And the third one, once he got to legal marriage age, was supposed to be given to Tamar, but she was not. So Tamar went and tricked Judah into thinking she was a temple prostitute in a local town, and he got her pregnant. And when she turned up pregnant, he ordered her stoned. When she was taken away to be stoned, she had captured his staff and his signet ring and his something that identified who he was. That's what she had taken when she had sex with him, because he didn't have a sheep to give her. And so when he came back to look for it, she wasn't around. So as she was being drug away, she sent these back to Judah, and she said, "By the man who owns these am I pregnant. This is who got me pregnant." And he realized that he had been the one who had impregnated her. In that process, somewhere in all of that, the grief of his father, the having to leave to get away, the living on his own, thinking for himself, dealing with all the hardship, being an alien in a foreign land, losing a son, losing another son, all of that troubled Judah's life. And he got to the place where his level of thinking was deep enough to understand more about God than his brothers did. And when Tamar was found to be pregnant by his own seed, Judah repented, and he called her in, and he said, "You're more righteous than I am. I am more sinful than you are, and we're not going to stone you, and I'm going to provide for you and care for you, give you your own tent, and set you aside, and you can live out your days." And Tamar had two sons, and one of them's name was Perez. She had twins. One of them's name was Perez, and Perez was the great-grandfather of King David. So Judah's ability to repent causes him to have a much deeper understanding of God and who we are and whatever. And Judah came home. He went back to his father's tribe and resubmitted himself to his father, a wiser man, a better man. And when they get ready to go down to Egypt to get food, it's Judah who is leading them in this thing. And when they are told, when Joseph tells them they've got to bring back Benjamin, and Jacob won't do it, Judah says, "I will be pledged for him." He steps up and offers his own life for Benjamin, which he had not done for Joseph. So we see this transformed man and all that he went through and what he went through and his ability to repent, which David respects that a lot because he talks about it a great deal, about when I was hiding my sins, my body wasted away, but when I repented from my sins, then you heard me, whatever. So Judah then becomes the kinsman redeemer of Israel's tribe. Zebulun shall dwell at the seashore. He shall have a haven for ships, and his flank shall be towards Sidon. So he's in the northeastern, his land's up in the northeastern part of Israel. This tribe lived near the Sea of Galilee and touched the Phoenician lands. They lived in the farthest north alongside Naphtali and were the subject of Isaiah's prophecy about the first coming of Christ in Isaiah chapter 9. A light will be seen in Israel, in Naphtali and Zebulun, that particular prophecy. They were the first to be captured by Israel's enemies and the last to be redeemed because of where they were. They were coming from the north. They were the first captured and the last set free. They were always the first to be captured by Israel's enemies. It is in Capernaum, around the Sea of Galilee, in their territory, that Jesus set up his ministry, which is why the prophecy talks about, "Blessed are you, Zebulun and Naphtali, for you shall see a great light, which shall come upon you." And it goes on to talk about Jesus of Nazareth. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to the burdens and became slave to forced labor. Issachar and his descendants became farmers and content to work the land and to submit to the Canaanites. Issachar never drove his Canaanites out, and they became submitted to them. They were eventually fierce fighters in support of Deborah and Barak in the story in Judges. That's who they were. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path, and bites a horse's heels, so that his rider falls backwards. For thy salvation I await, O Lord. He means salvation from Dan. God help us from Dan. This small northernmost tribe was nonetheless fierce against its enemies. They were also treacherous, eventually attacking several groups of innocent people outside the land of Israel to establish their homeland. Innocent people who were citizens of Tyre and Sidon but lived far away from them. And they went in and they captured them and slaughtered them and took their land for the land of Dan. Treacherous people. They acted viciously to steal a group's Levite, one case, and to steal innocent people's land, another, Judges 18. As they were going north, they found a man who had a Levite priest, and they coerced him to come with them and threatened to kill the guy whose priest he was. These people were treacherous people. Dan is not referenced in the list of the tribes in either 1 Chronicles or the book of Revelation. By the time we get to 1 Chronicles and Revelation, Dan is no longer thought of as a tribe anymore because of who they were. Some have thought him to be a type of the Antichrist. Judges in the Old Testament were rulers over people, and Dan is thought of as a bad one. That's another nice inheritance there. As for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he shall raid at their heels. Gad lived in Transjordan. He lived east of the Jordan River. And he was constantly being attacked by the Amorites on the east side, back and forth, and attacking back and whatever. He was subject to constant raids by the Amorites, and it made them tough and resourceful. As for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. So south of Naphtali and Zebulun, closer to the sea, is Asher. Asher's territory is plush. It's lush. It was a great place for farming. And it's also protected. It's got buffer zones. So it's usually at peace. And the tribe of Asher became known for its vegetation. And they provided all the food for David's palace, for Tyre and Sidon's palaces. That's where you bought your... They're the Whole Foods or whatever of the era. But that's where you bought your best food for your best people for the best money, for the most money. Dwelling in lush areas, Asher grew the palace food for Tyre, Sidon, and Jerusalem. Deuteronomy 33, this story. Naphtali is a doe let loose. He has beautiful words. All the disciples except Judas and much of the ministry of the Lord came out of the territory of Naphtali. Now, they didn't all come out of the tribe of Naphtali, but they lived in Naphtali's territory during the time of Christ. So Peter, James and John were cousins of Jesus, so they were therefore tribe of Judah. But these people all lived near Sea of Galilee, north of Nazareth, around Chorazin and Bethsaida, etc., etc. Naphtali is a doe let loose. He has beautiful words. So beautiful words, glad tidings will come from his area, gospel. That's what that is. Judas is actually comes from Judea in the south. The rest of them are all up in there. Good news, the gospel, and other beautiful words come out with them. Matthew 4. Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. And its branches ran over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him. But his bow remained firm and his arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above. Blessings of the deep that lies beneath. Blessings of the breast, of the womb, and of the womb. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one who is distinguished among his brothers. Joseph would have been his kinsman redeemer, but he was too busy ruling the world. He was his favorite son from the beginning, and he just blesses the socks off of him. Between Manasseh and Ephraim, they got the most land and had the most people. They were the biggest group. Joseph is noble, fruitful, and powerful, he says. He overcomes his enemies. He is preeminent among his brothers. So even though people went after him to try to kill him and hurt him, Joseph prevailed. Joseph is given, he and his children will dwell in blessing. Joseph is given two portions in Israel. Both his son Ephraim and his son Manasseh were numbered among the tribes each in land distribution, replacing Levi. Eventually, Ephraim becomes a leader of the northern kingdom. Manasseh receives the largest distribution of land, with the possible exception of Judah, but between Manasseh and Ephraim, they are largest. Benjamin. So far we've had really good blessings for Judah and Joseph, some halfway decent blessings for Asher and a couple people, and some down and out kicking the teeth to three or four guys here. Remember, Jacob was never overly fond of his sons anyway, if you think about it, especially since they did what they did to him. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, in the evening he divides the spoil. So Benjamin is warlike in nature and defeats his enemies through military might. Among his descendants are King Saul and his royal military family. Another combative descendant of Benjamin was Saul of Tarsus. So the people of Benjamin are scrappy. The first king of Israel was the son of Benjamin, Saul, and his tribal brother Judah became the king of Judah after Saul was gone. So all the power rests in their hands. Ultimately, see, at one point, Benjamin, the combative people of Benjamin, actually went to war against the rest of Israel over the men of Jabesh-Gilead, Judges chapters 19 and 20. We read that once upon a time. You can go back and look at that. Ultimately, Benjamin sided with the tribe of Judah and eventually with King David, especially in the difficult capture of Jebus, the site of Jerusalem, which lies within the territory of Benjamin. So when we have the northern and southern tribes, two tribes in the south are Benjamin and Judah, the northern tribes are the other ten. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and that is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, every one, with a blessing appropriate to him. Then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for the burial site. A long time ago we read this story also. Then they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it purchased from the sons of Heth. So I want to be buried next to Leah there. Nobody knows where the body of Rachel is. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet in the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face, and he wept over him and he kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants, the physician, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming, and the Egyptians wept for him for 70 days. Embalming actually takes 40 days and 30 days more to wrap it in preservatives. That's why it's 70 days. So he's one of the, like the pharaohs, he was embalmed and sent back to the cave of Machpelah.
And when?
Yes.
Why are the Egyptians wept for him?
Because he was Joseph's father. Joseph is big among the Hyksos Egyptians.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, he's a big guy. If George Bush 41, dies tomorrow, the Democrats will weep for him. I'm not sure about George Bush 43, but anyway, they will. Thought of an honorable man. Anyway. So Genesis 50, this is the last chapter in Genesis. When the days of mourning for him were past, 70 days, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I'm about to die. In my grave which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and then I will return. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, all the elders of the land of Egypt, all the household of Joseph, his brothers, his father's household. They left only their little ones and their flocks and their herds in the land of Goshen. So not only did the family go up, all the adults in the families go up, but all of Pharaoh's nobles went up. All the heads of all of the Pharaoh's government went up to Machpelah, to the land of Canaan, where the sons of Heth were, to bury Jacob in that cave there. So it was quite an entourage that came rolling into Canaan at this particular point. Strange group of people. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went all these people that I just talked about. There also went with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. So they didn't walk so much as ride in their chariots over. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshold of the floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Some reason the Egyptians have come here and they're having this incredible mourning that they're doing." Therefore, it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had charged them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. So due to their clothing, chariots, and overall look, the funeral participants are thought to be Egyptians. Joseph and his retinue and their Egyptian garb and transport would have stood out among the crowd. Verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph should hear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for the wrong which we did to him?" Now this is 22 years later. So 22 years later, they're still worried about Joseph taking revenge on them now that their father has died.
22 years after
they're reestablished.
Buried.
Yes. 22 years after Joseph and his family are reestablished, and Joseph and Jacob are back together. You know, Joseph went through that process of forgiving his brothers and all that kind of stuff. And then he came and brought them up to the land, you know, all that sort of thing. But 22 years have passed since that time, and they're still worried that he's going to take revenge on them, just because of Lex Talionis runs so deep in the Semitic people. What if he thinks about this and decides to take vengeance on us? So they send a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong.'" So they say, "Then now please forgive the transgressions of the servants to the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And his brothers also came and fell down upon before him, said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place?' They said to him, 'Please forgive the servants of the God of our father.'" Not our God, of the God of our father. Your God and your father's God. "Please forgive them, us." And Joseph wept because he sort of can't believe it, that after all these years, they're still thinking this way. And so he tells them, "You know, you guys, you don't get it. You don't understand. You don't understand how God thinks, what God would do. I told you 22 years ago that I forgave you, and I meant it then. And everything I've done since then has been to your benefit. And you're still have no faith in what's going on." So Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? Should I judge you? Am I God to you? Should I judge you? Your deeds will find you out. Your deeds will have its own punishment, and that's between you and God." Some of you just got it in the blessing ceremony about a week ago. But your deeds will find you out. It's not my job to punish you for what you did to me. "Now as for you, you meant evil against me. There's no doubt about that. What you meant to kill me. You meant to destroy me. You meant to sell me away permanently. You meant for bad to happen to me. We're not dressing this up and saying, oh, it was a mistake. You had hate and bitterness and murder in your hearts. But God meant it for good in order to bring about the present result, to preserve many people alive. So even though you meant to kill me, there's a God in heaven, and He is sovereign over all of this. And He allowed it to happen because He had a purpose for it. And he meant that to happen for me for my good and for the good of everybody else, because this happened to allow me to come into a place to provide provision, salvation, physical salvation for your family, our family, Egypt, and all the lands around, because of what God did in moving me into Pharaoh's right-hand position. So that you did, which was evil, God redeemed it and used it for His purposes. So I'm thinking about what God redeemed, not what you did at this point. Other than Jesus, there's no one in the Bible who seems to understand God better than does Joseph. Now, I didn't say that lightly. When I say no one in the Bible, I mean Abraham, I mean Noah. There's no one in the Bible who demonstrates an understanding of God like Jesus, other than Joseph. Now, you think about Abraham, he's the father of our faith, he's certainly a great man. We're not trying to diminish anybody. And Noah was, you know, good, and Seth was good. Those are some of the greatest people that there were. But think about Joseph. Joseph was raised up by his father from his youth, and he was given a great deal of spiritual and moral guidance for his first 18 years. He was gifted by God with a sense of prophecy and understanding, the ability to read dreams, the ability to understand what God was saying. And these things he developed like David. And David would probably be the close second. These things he developed like David. And then when he was thrown into the well and then into captivity, rather than curse God because of what all happened, he reverts to his training and is faithful without exception to God for 12 years. So for 12 full years in slavery, falsely accused, put into prison, his situation keeps going like this, and his faith with God is as level as it can be. And he trusts God, and he praises God, and when he is brought before Pharaoh, he is there to give God credit for what all God does, and he doesn't hold it against God. His maturity is startling, especially for a man who didn't have the Holy Spirit on a regular, ongoing basis. So when you look at who Joseph was, what he faced, Abraham never faced anything like Joseph faced. Neither did Noah. None of the things they went through were the betrayal of your family, being made a slave, being put into prison for false accusation, and having your situation just keep going further and further south, and still maintaining a relationship of faith. All salvation is based in relationship, and all relationship is based in trust. And Joseph shows us the trust of God, like Jesus does, but unlike anybody else I can find in the Bible, given the circumstances that he went through and whatever. So I recommend Joseph to you. He's always been my hero. You meant me for evil, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them, and he spoke kindly to them. Verse 22. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, and the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died in the age of 110. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. So he lives long and prospers, seeing the birth of his great-great-grandchildren. He asks for and receives the commitment of his brothers and their descendants to bring his bones up. And remember the Ten Commandments? The bones of Joseph are being carried out when they're leaving. The book of Genesis is the story of the creation, the fall, the lives of the patriarchs of God's people. It is the foundation biblical narrative A good understanding of Genesis provides context for all that follows. Hopefully, this study has given you that context, the foundation. Comments?
What was the bit about the Ten Commandments?
The movie Ten Commandments, as the people are leaving, that scene where all leaving and there's cowbells and people and babies being born, there's one scene in which they see the bones of Joseph being taken by the priest on a bier, being moved, and there's all holy music at that point in time. But that's taking Joseph's bones back. Which, you know, if you think about this, those bones got carried for over 40 years before they were ever placed in the burial site. 40 years. He was embalmed. It's a good thing, huh?
Yeah.
All right. That's Genesis, folks. We just went through Genesis. Genesis is one of my top two or three favorite books of the whole Bible, maybe the best one, because of what all it teaches us, what all it says. And I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Any comments?
This is quick. Are the rules that the Jewish people today follow for burial, are those in Leviticus or what?
Mm-hmm. A lot of them are. A lot of what they do, especially in Israel, we probably ought to quit and somebody pray us out.